trying to turn it down. So, every Christian knows that every good thing that we have comes from God. If we have something that's good, God gave it to us. Every Christian knows also that every good thing God gives to us, He sometimes removes from us also. Time's up. Time to take that away, give it to somebody else. One can never tell. And every Christian knows that the proper response to such a situation is not to lament and say, why don't I have that anymore? But to say, thank God for the time I could have that. With that in mind, the Zabrowskis are leaving tomorrow. They have been more than just a pleasure to get to know. Nicole's faith has been strong, and we have been impressed by it and encouraged by it, and we can see that she is passing it on to her children. Patrick is our good friend. We're going to miss you. And we pray that life continues to go well for you and God is patient with you all. God is patient with us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here this morning. But we're here to try to become better people, to be more like Christ. And that's why we're here. That's why we're together. If something occurs in this assembly that doesn't help that, then we need to cut it out. If you are curious about what we're doing or think that we've done something wrong, please talk to us later. And let us know. And if we can help each other, then we'll be better for it. Today, you may or may not be surprised to find that we're going to start in 1 Samuel chapter 18. You may recall 1 Samuel chapter 17 that we studied for the last couple of weeks. 1 Samuel 17, there's this big man, Goliath. And there's this not-so-big man, David. Nobody thinks David is able. David runs up to him. Hits him in the head with a stone, because that's what God did for him. And then David takes this knife, this sword, and cuts off his head. And comes back, and Saul says, who was that? Verse 55 of chapter 17. Saul said, saw David going out against the Philistine. He said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this young man? And Abner said, by your life, O king, I do not know. The king said, you inquire whose son this youth is. So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. Now it came about, when he had finished speaking that Saul, to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as himself. Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan stripped himself of his robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered. Then Saul set him over the men of war. And listen to this. It was pleasing in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. This is the, who is that man, to who hasn't heard of David moment. Before here, nobody heard of David. After here, everybody knows who David is. Saul, his son, Jonathan, is making covenants with him, loves him, giving him his stuff so that he can be an effective warrior. Not only that, David has women singing songs about him. Verse 6, it happened when David returned from killing the Philistine that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines and joy with musical instruments. The women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Wow, superstar is what this guy turned into overnight practically. Now, then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. It may say something in your version like it stabbed him in his eyes, or the idea is that the noise was very loud to him. He didn't like it. Oh, it hurt him to hear it. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. All right, the point of this story is that David's fame increases while Saul's fear increases. These two are increasing at the same time. We'll see that over and over. But understand, it was God's will that David become king. We actually haven't read that, but you know the story. 1 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 16. Saul, now he might not have known that it was David that was going to take over, but Saul knew he had lost the kingship. He knew that by now. So when this is going on, instead of saying, what more can he have but the kingdom, Saul should have been happy. Maybe asked him and said, hey, are you God's new king? And if so, then here are the keys. But Saul doesn't take that approach. Instead, he is looking at David with suspicion. Turn with me to 1 Corinthians 13, if you can get there quickly enough. I'll probably read it by the time you're done. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things. I'm amazed at the number of times this little passage just keeps on popping up in my mind. Two people in the same situation. One of them is saying, I seriously question what you're thinking while you're doing it. The other one is saying, I'm not even going to go there. I refuse to think about that until I have some solid evidence in front of me. That's the biblical approach. Saul takes the unbiblical approach. If you had gone up to David and asked him, David, are you trying by going out and killing the Philistine and killing all these other people and getting these women to sing about you, are you trying to take over the kingship? Now, David had been anointed by now, but I don't think that was his plan. He was just doing what he does. And we know from chapter 17, it was in the service of God. Whatever can be good for God's country, I'm going to do it for him, David says. In other words, David's innocent. But yet Saul here is thinking, hey, wait a minute. You're up to something. Now, David had no designs on this, but you know what Saul was? Obsessed. He was obsessed with something that he wanted, that God didn't want him to have anymore. That's the short of it. And everything had to fit that reality, didn't it? Here are two things about being obsessed. Number one, they obscure reason, truth, and reality. You could have gone up, you could have dropped 1,000 leaflets over Saul's kingdom saying, David is innocent. Saul never would have got it. You could have hit him in the head with a 2x4 with it stamped on it. David is innocent. Saul never would have got it. He never does. Because he's obsessed. Now, obsession also are the base upon which to build other things that are not good. You know the expression, misery loves company? So do obsessions, right? In fact, that's what this story is partially about. 1 Samuel chapter 18, Saul had become angry. Verse 10, Saul begins his first attempt to remove what he calls, or what I'm calling, he's thinking is the problem. It came about the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul. He raved in the midst of the house. Your version may say prophesied. Something like he was acting like a lunatic, basically, what's going on. While David was playing the harp with his hand, as usual, a spear was in Saul's hand. He hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall, but David escaped from his presence twice. Notice, I say this is his first attempt, but there's actually two attempts here. Note well, obsessions can take you further than you ever thought they could. What does he start with? A little anger. Well, very angry. But before he was very angry, he was a little angry. Right? Saul became very angry. And the next thing you know, he's thinking ill of this person. These two are sins in and of themselves that need to be forgiven. Matthew 5, look, if you're angry against your brother, what do? You're guilty before the court. He's angry. And then he takes it a step further. I'm going to think, this is causing division right here. I'm suspicious of you. What are you up to? And then, how far does he take it? Murder. He's willing to attempt murder. He throws a spear at him. Obsession can take you further away than you want to go and keep you longer than you want to stay. Well, David, verse 12, Saul was afraid of David. Remember, that's part of the theme going on here. For the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. David prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When Saul that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. But all Israel loved Judah, all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. Here's a point to be made. No matter what you choose, God's will be done. That's part of the story here. Turn to Romans chapter 11. By the way, keep a marker if you want to in 1 Samuel 19. Romans chapter 11, verse 36. Verse 36, this is about God the Father. For from him and through him and to him are all things. What does that mean? He created the world. Number two, he's keeping the world running. And in the end, guess what's going to be left? Things that are praising him. That's the short of it, if you will. Now, there's an illustration of this. The Israelites themselves, this is what chapter 11 is about. The Israelites themselves, they had killed the Messiah, and in killing the Messiah, God rejected them. But in God rejecting them and them killing the Messiah, guess who the Messiah became available to? All of the world. Isn't that amazing? That our God is so wise and so powerful that he can come up with a plan to use men and still succeed in what he wants. And this is the point of Romans chapter 11. For from him and through him and to him are all things. So guess what? What he wants to happen, no matter what you choose, will happen. This is a point we see over and over again in 1 Samuel chapter 18. We're going to see it over again. Now, the next part of this short little lesson is the invitation. The lesson is not so short. Usually the invitation comes at the end, not today. The invitation is going to come in the middle. Thoughts from death row. A man named William Van Poyck from Florida. Maybe you from Florida recognize that name. He murdered a man. It was a botched attempt to escape from prison, to help somebody else escape from prison. It went south, and he ended up shooting a man and murdering him. So he gets put on, he gets the capital punishment. While he's awaiting his death, for years, he wrote a couple books, he writes a blog, and he writes letters to his sister. This, what I'm about to read, is part of a letter to his sister. Now, he's on death row. He's got, I don't know, from this part, I don't know how long he has to die. But he's on death row. There are three of them down there. Well, up above him, literally the floor above him, there's somebody who is not sentenced with death, but commits suicide. Now, he writes his thoughts about this. The irony wasn't lost on me that while three of us on death watch are fighting to live, this poor soul, living just 10 feet above us, stripped of all hope, had voluntarily surrendered his life rather than continue his dismal existence when nothing but a lifetime of suffering lays ahead, with no hope, no promise, no opportunity to change your fate. The idea of utter annihilation can come to look appealing in contrast. This is what this man on death row writes. By the way, he was executed this last Friday. A couple of words. Stripped of all hope, nothing but a lifetime of suffering lays ahead. With no hope, no promise, no opportunity to change your fate. What a dismal existence. The idea of utter annihilation can come to look appealing in contrast. But guess what? In hell, utter annihilation isn't an option. This is where you're stuck. Let's read it again. No hope, no promise, no opportunity to change your fate. And that is where you are stuck forever in hell. Now, these people here, they're in prison. Don't you think they should have thought about this before they committed the crime? What about life? we better think about these things before life is over. Because when life is over, judgment comes. And if you're stuck in this situation, there is no opportunity to change. You can change. Hear the gospel. You've heard it. If you're in this audience, pretty much you've heard it. Believe it. Confess Jesus as your Lord. Repent. Stop doing what you have been doing. Do good things that is written about. Be baptized. And then live a faithful life until death or He comes. You can change your outcome. You can change your fate now. And we offer the invitation to you to do that. Now, getting back to the point of the story, David's fame increases while Saul's fear increases. Remember, we're saying that no matter what you choose, God's will be done. It's going to happen. Well, his first attempt, by the way, at removing the problem didn't work, did it? He threw the spear at David, and David ran away, and not only that, David's popularity increases. Verse 17, Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merab." Here's opportunity, attempt number two to eliminate David. "I will give her to you as a wife, only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "My hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." But David said to Saul, "Who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son of all?" So it came about that at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Maholathite, for a wife. Now, Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. When they told Saul the thing was agreeable to him, Saul thought, "I will give her to him that she may become a snare for him and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Here's number two daughter that he's willing to sacrifice. His obsession, he doesn't even care about his own family. That's how far he's willing to go. Not one daughter, but two daughters. Therefore, verse 21, Saul said to David, "For a second time you may be my son-in-law today." Then Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David secretly, saying, 'Behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law.' So Saul's servants spoke these words to David. But David said, 'Is it a trivial thing in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I'm a poor man and lightly esteemed?" In other words, look, they expect a dowry. He's poor. He doesn't have the cash to give to the king. How can that happen? So the king comes up with an alternative plan. The servants of Saul, verse 24, reported to him according to these words which David spoke. Saul then said, "Thus you shall say to David, 'The king does not require any dowry except 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take the vengeance on the king's enemies.'" Now Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. When his servants told David these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. Before the days had expired, Saul, David rose up and went, and he and his men, and struck down 200 men of the Philistines. Don't mess with David when it comes to killing people. He does it in shorter time and more people. Then David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. Attempt number three really has failed. So Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, for a wife. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, and his name was highly esteemed. If you were taking an approval rating poll, you would see David skyrocketing, and Saul maybe staying the same at best, if not going down. Remember, God's will be done. Now, this may be one of the saddest endings of a story, and it's not actually the end of the story, that we read. Did you notice that in verse 29? Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. You know, Saul had already pushed God away. That is the worst. But the second, and like unto it, is pushing away another person. Yet that's exactly what has happened here. Turn with me to Psalm 133. Psalm 133. Notice it is a song of ascents of David. David writes this psalm. Psalm 133. Behold, how good and how pleasant it is for brothers to dwell in unity. He's talking about relationships. Now he uses some lofty language here. It is like the precious oil upon the head coming down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard, coming down upon the edge of his robes. My version gives the idea that's all the way on the bottom. Other versions give the idea that it's right around the collar. It doesn't matter. The point is that this guy is soaked in this oil. Now, this is back before the days where you just run down to Walmart and pick up some perfume. This oil is made by the perfumers. That's what you read when you read the Pentateuch, right? So here what he's talking about is this sweet-smelling fragrance that when this priest came in the room, you knew it, and you said, wow, doesn't that smell wonderful? David is saying, just like that is so wonderful to the senses, so is a relationship of brotherhood. Verse 3, it is like the dew of Hermon coming down upon the mountains of Zion. So we have dew, which is watering the land, sustaining the land. At the highest mountains, Hermon, and also at the lowest of mountains, Zion. Everybody gets to partake of this. Now listen to this. For there the Lord commanded the blessing, life forever. You notice three times it had said, coming down, coming down, coming down, coming down. And then it ends with, for there the Lord commanded. Don't miss the imagery. When you have a good relationship with somebody, you know who that's a blessing from? God himself. And David is saying, isn't that just the sweetest thing? How sad David couldn't say that about Saul. It wasn't going to work with Saul. In fact, in 2 Samuel chapter 1, this is when David sings about Saul's death. Saul and Jonathan had been killed in battle. David laments about it. Verse 23. 2 Samuel 1:23. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. And yet he can't say that about Saul, can he? Here's the sad truth. It takes only one person to spoil a good thing. Never forget this. Saul by himself created division between himself and another. You could go to anybody in the world at that time and say, are you responsible for the division that's between you and David? Between Saul and David? And the only person that could answer that, yes, is Saul. Nobody else could answer it. Saul by himself thwarted an otherwise smooth God-designed transition of leadership. I'm not sure exactly how God had it in mind. I don't know how that was. But I know that Saul is rejected, David is accepted, and the next thing you know, you see the two fighting. And it wasn't David's fault. Saul is the one. I am reminded of Diotrephes in 3 John. 3 John verse 9, I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept what we say. For this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds, which he does. Unjustly accusing us with wicked words, and not satisfied with this, he himself does not receive the brethren either, and he forbids those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church. Wow, this guy has got a mess behind him anywhere he goes. And only one person, Diotrephes. And John focuses right in on him because he's messing everything up. When Marcy and I moved to Hungary, before we actually moved to Hungary, but especially while we were there, we kept on hearing one name over and over and over. The church in Hungary grew up to 30 people years before we were there. And then in comes, among other things, this one person. And when he was done, by the time we're there, there are four Christians. We heard this guy's name over and over on that side of the ocean and this side of the ocean. Then when that guy leaves there, he goes down to Africa. And I happened to be in the living room with a man, a preacher, who always went to this one church in Africa. And this man says to me, "Do you know this guy?" I said, "I don't know him. I only know of him." The man in the living room, the preacher, had been helping this church in Africa for years. Mr. Destructive had gone down there. He was there for 6 months. And when our preacher went down there to help this church, as he had been doing for years, Mr. Destructive said to him, "What are you doing here? This is my church now." One person can destroy anything. Look in Titus chapter 3. In Titus chapter 3, verse 10, reject, and my version uses the word a factious man after a first and second warning. All right, this word factious. BDAG says, to causing divisions, factious, division-making. Pertaining to causing divisions, divisive. One who causes divisions. The ESV says, one who stirs up division. We understand the word division. Now, Jesus had prayed in John 17 that you all may be one. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians that you all speak the same thing. So this is the opposite of that. Now, do you notice what he says? Reject a factious person. You mean we don't have to wait until there's three or four of them? No. Why? Because one person can do total damage, can change the destiny, if you will, of a church. With that in mind, here's the question. What about me? What about myself? Any given right now, am I this person? Am I being like him? Look in Romans 11:36. It's the second time we'll turn here, and we won't turn here again. 11:36. Remember, God's will is going to happen. It's going to be done. Look in the second part of that. To him be the glory forever. Amen. Paul is saying, and I'm going to be on the right side. That's what Paul is saying here. Now listen, God's will be done no matter what you do. You can choose to be actively participating in his will getting done or passively used by God. There's your choices. I know what I choose. Active. Now the question is, we always have to examine ourselves. Any given right now, am I really doing what I want to do or what I have claimed to do? Claimed I said I would do. Then, the sad truth is, sometimes Satan gets the best of us. An evil spirit from God came mightily, upon Saul. So I messed up the typing. But you understand, that's not directly from God. You can read passages like Job. God's in complete control of everything. So sometimes, accommodatively, we use the language, look, if something happened, God did it. It really means he allowed it. Job 1 and 2 and chapter 42, right? Okay. In 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22. Flee from youthful lusts. Pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those who call upon the Lord from a pure heart. But refuse foolish and ignorant speculations, knowing that they produce quarrels. The Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be kind to all, able to teach, patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition, if perhaps God may grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of truth. Okay, stop here. So, if you see somebody who is wrong, you go up and you teach them and teach them and teach them, and then it says, if perhaps God may allow them to see the truth. Well, that's kind of odd. Look what it says. Verse 26, and they come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. Here is one example of that. Peter. Do you remember Peter? I have up here, Satan sometimes gets the best of us. I would consider Peter to be one of the best of us. But it doesn't matter who it is. Any of us can fall. Now, Peter stood condemned, Paul writes in Galatians chapter 2, because of his hypocrisy. Because he was saying, you Gentiles, you need to live like Jews, when he knew that wasn't the case. Paul comes up to him and says, look, Peter, you got to repent. Peter snaps out of it. He comes to his senses. But again, the question is, what about me, myself, right any given now? Am I captive in the snare, not in my senses at any given time? Maybe. I know it can happen to the best of us. The warnings are manifold. Be careful. Now, if you are a person that has identified somebody else in this situation, by the way, the rest of this is kind of free, look what it says. Verse 23, refuse foolish and ignorant speculations. Verse 24, the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be kind to all, able to teach, patient when wronged. It might be so the case that not only are they ensnared, but they have done something wrong to you. Well, what do you do then? Patient when wronged. Do you remember, David never took it personally. All his many years, he never took it personally. That's a good example for us to follow. Maybe he understood that Saul, it just wasn't in his senses. I'm sure that David thought that, right? At the same time, realize that you are in a 2 Timothy 2:24 through 26 situation. That's what's going on here. And so what do? Well, you continue to patiently teach in gentleness. That's what it says. You just keep on doing what's right and pray your heart out. And then, remember, God's will be done. You just keep on doing it as you are able. Now, I want to take the rest of the lesson to look at this passage, this first Samuel, from a different perspective. Something else to think about, two guys and a girl. I saved this toward the end because I know that that title would get the young people's attention. Now, Gary read from Proverbs 31. The latter half of that is, here's a good woman. Guys, go get that woman. Women, be that woman. Now, depending on how you say this, you can't really find a passage like that about guys. You can say the passage is about elders, but basically what you have to do, and it's really the same with women, is compile everything and say this is who you got to be. All right, now, young girls, I'm speaking specifically to the young and older, if you're single. And when I say single and young, I mean if you're even remotely thinking about someday getting married, pay attention, you young ladies. Here's a snapshot of one guy. You're in life. That's what happens. You're in life. And you've got to figure out what's going on. You have to assess the situation. So let's assess Saul. He's a guy. All right. Number one, he's unable to lead, isn't he? That's from last week, really. 2 weeks ago. Saul, when the Philistines stood up, Goliath stood up, guess what all the army did? Shook in their boots. That's where a king comes in and says, let's go. Saul didn't do it. He couldn't lead. He was unable, and I say unable in quotes, because he really was able. He chose not to make room for another to receive glory and honor. David, they're talking about him, not me. Then, unable to let go of something God was taking away from him, and he knew it. Unable to hope all things. Unable to control himself. He threw a spear. You might not get a spear thrown at you, but you might get some words or, God forbid, a fist. You don't know. He's a man. That's what we're looking at. Unable to quit being against the Lord. Unable to recognize there is no difference between direct and indirect involvement in sin. He says to himself, you know what? I'm not going to kill him, but I'll just have the Philistines kill him. I'll set him up for that. Hello? Unable to love his daughters. He is willing to put them in a situation where their husband is murdered. Nice guy. Thanks, Dad. Father's Day. Unable to keep his word when the first daughter should have been given to David, she was not. And then a manipulator. Over and over, that's all he does. He tries to manipulate the situation. Now, contrast him with David. Now, we didn't read this passage, but we understand that David is a man after God's own heart. Okay, ladies? Which do you choose? What a silly question, huh? David. You choose the David. This is what a ridiculous question. It's obvious you choose the David. You look for the David. You wait for the David to come along. Where's the David? And until the David comes along, I'm just going to settle down. Okay. What if Saul didn't have any of these bad qualities? None of them. What do you know about Saul? Not a thing. You don't know anything about him. You know what he isn't, but you really don't know what he is. Now, here's where faith steps in. Saul is tall, dark, and handsome, and established. Whereas David is little and ruddy and young. What are you going to do? All right, let's step it up a notch. What about Saul? What if he had just maybe some good qualities? After all, he did recognize the value of David. He said, give me that boy. He ain't going home. Not only that, he used the word Lord a couple times, didn't he? In a context where he used it. He wasn't using the Lord's name in vain, was he? He was saying, go out there and fight the Lord's battle. This is what we call religious speak. He was doing it. And if you think, now we know the end of the story, but pretend you don't, because they didn't. He says, I'm going to give you my daughter. Wow. You know, he's coming around, David thinks. He used to throw spears at me, but now he's going to give me his daughter. He's throwing his daughter at me. Wow, maybe there's some hope for him. Now, let's enter our discussion, okay? What are the young ladies going to think in this situation? Saul, maybe he is changing. Maybe he has potential. After all, you don't know the end of the story. You only know where you are and you see these things. Maybe he is changing. Maybe he's got potential. Right. Well, so I'll just go ahead and date him? Well, you use whatever word you want to for date. Get to know him better? I don't know what word you get the point. I'm going to develop my relationship with this guy with the end goal of marriage? That doesn't make sense. You're going to base it all on a maybe? Meanwhile, there's a David out there, isn't there, somewhere? In theory, there's a David out there. What are you going to do? Okay? Maybe I can change him. Famous last words. By the way, did you notice that God had been trying just for a little while to change Saul? And I don't mean that God failed, but if God can't do it, who do you think you are? Meanwhile, there's a David out there. Hang on. In order to get his way, Saul, in order to get his way, this guy told another guy anything that guy wanted to hear and gave him his daughter. You go out and you tell David that I really like him. What does that sound like? If this guy will do it to another guy, what do you think he'll do to a girl? He'll tell the girl or act any way the girl wants to get what he wants. This is what Saul is doing with David. Guys do this. So the question is, well, is he changing? Or maybe this is the situation. Be very careful. And remember, there's a David. Hang out for David. Wait for David. But love hopes all things. I did say that. Mr. Preacher, you said that love hopes all things. Number one, who is saying this? Who would even consider Saul but one who is obsessed? One who has to have something. I've got to have it, and here he is. This is one that will satisfy the it that I need. Otherwise, nobody who is not obsessed would think these things. They just back off and say, wait a minute. Now, love hopes all things. That is true to a degree. Yes, when tempted to think ill of somebody. But love is not naive. Do you remember elders? Do not point a recent convert as an elder. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 6. Well, why not? Love hopes all things, doesn't it? Love is not naive. Love does not think ill of somebody without true evidence. But love doesn't just say, okay, if I'm not going to think ill of somebody, then I'm just going to do whatever I want. At the same time, remember this, your man will be your father, your children's father, your grandchildren's grandfather, your great-grandchildren's great-grandfather, children whom you, God has given to you to train up to have a heart that is after God's own heart. Remember, while you're thinking about this and making the decision, this goes way beyond you yourself. This will influence not only other people in your generation, but generations to come. Think very, very carefully. Let me illustrate it this way. When I first met Marcy's great uncle or granduncle, however you want to look at it, grandfather's brother, essentially, brother-in-law, he literally stepped out of the car. This is in Oklahoma. He stepped out of the car and walked up to me with a piece of paper, a big piece of paper that had 100 pictures on it. And all these pictures are the old preachers from Oklahoma and Texas and Tennessee and Kentucky from what we would call the Reformation. And he shows to me, he says, I'm related to that guy and that guy and that guy and that guy. He was related to them through his marriage. In other words, it's actually Marcy's family on her mother's side that is related to all these people. Okay. But think of that. Think of the wealth of experience, the relationships, the faith that this man is referring to that's been going on for years and years and years, and all part of that, he's part of it, and now Marcy is too. Contrast that with my dad's father, who died of emphysema from smoking, alone, an alcoholic. Bought Frank Sinatra a drink one time. Ooh. The letters that I had the sad privilege of reading. He divorced my mother when my dad was only 1 year old. He would send my dad letters. Oh, they always had money. They also had, sorry I couldn't make it up this weekend like I said I could, but I had to go to the horses. Here are your options. Do you want the father, the grandfather, the great-grandfather of your children to be like my dad's dad or like Marcy's family that she comes from years, years back? It will always affect your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. This is much bigger than just you and your husband. By the way, all this really applies to you and your wife too, right? Everything that I'm saying. Now, let me finish with this passage. 2 Samuel 6. This woman, Micah, that David ends up marrying, makes a mistake. A mistake that she will go on to never forget. All right. 2 Samuel 6, David wanted to move the ark. He moved it the wrong way. God struck as a dead. David said, well, how can I move it? Later on, he's figured out how to move it. And so he's moving it. As he's moving it, verse 13, so it was that when the bearers of the ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling. And David was dancing before the Lord with all his might. David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord. It was shouting and the sound of trumpet. A joyous, joyous occasion. And David is out there enraptured in what's going on. Verse 16. When it happened, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him with her heart. Look in verse 20. When David returned to bless his household, Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to David and said to him, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today! He uncovered himself today in the eyes of his servants' maids as one of the foolish ones, shamelessly uncovers himself." See, there's a bit of jealousy going on here. Listen to David's response. David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as ruler of the people of the Lord over Israel. Therefore, I will celebrate before the Lord. I will be lightly esteemed, more lightly esteemed than this, and will be humble in my own eyes. But with the maids of whom you have spoken, with them I will be distinguished." In other words, David's saying, look, you've got to get the right attitude here. I was celebrating before the Lord, and you completely missed that. Now, what happens next? Verse 23, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. All right, it does not say that God caused it. But here we have Michal, confused, saying the wrong thing with the wrong attitude, David chastising her, and the next thing you know, she's barren the rest of her life. I can't help but put the two together. Now let me ask you, do you think she died happy? Or do you think she died regretting that silly mistake that she made years before? I think you know the answer. See, here's the point. Some mistakes cannot be undone. You just have to live with them. That was her situation. Now here's the question to ask. What's better? Children raised wrong or no children at all? And what I mean by this, behind this no children at all, is not getting married, because usually if you get married, generally speaking, children follow. So here's the question. What's better? To not get married or to get married and have children who are brought up to be condemned? That's where you stand. Here's the point. Think very, very carefully. Hold out for David. You have listened very well. Thank you for your patience.